When we think about how the world works, we usually picture it like a grand stage play.
Right, yeah, with all the drama and the spotlights.
Exactly. We completely obsess over the actors standing under that spotlight, like the politicians giving these fiery speeches or the famous billionaires splashed across magazine covers.
Oh, totally. Because they're the ones visibly delivering the lines. They absorb all the attention by design.
Right. We point at them and we say, "There it is. There's the power." But if you really want to understand the play, looking at the actors just isn't enough.
No, it really isn't.
You have to ask, like, who owns the theater? Who actually wrote the script? Who has their hand on the switch that controls the spotlight? And maybe most importantly, who decides who even gets to audition in the first place?
That is the perfect way to frame it.
Yeah, so welcome to today's deep dive.
Yeah.
We are thrilled to have you with us as we unpack a really fascinating July 2026 report. It's published by the American newspaper and American TV, and it's titled State Ruling Class and Social Ruling Class.
And this document, I mean, it is just incredible.
It really gave me an absolute aha moment. It completely reframes how we look at authority. We usually ask a very simple, surface-level question, right? Who is powerful?
Right, which is the wrong question entirely.
Exactly. This report argues we should be asking through which institution, resource, and decision process is power actually exercised?
Yeah, and for you listening, whether you're, I don't know, prepping for a boardroom meeting, trying to make sense of global politics, or you're just someone who wants to understand the mechanics of the world you live in, grasping this architecture of domination is essential.
It really is.
Because what's fascinating here is that this framework protects you from two very common, very dangerous traps.
Right, I love this part.
The first is naive pluralism. That's the comforting but demonstrably false idea that everyone in a democracy has equal access to influence.
Like, we all have the exact same voice.
Exactly, which just isn't true. And the second trap is the totalizing conspiracy theory. You know, the paranoid idea that a secret cabal in a smoke-filled room controls every single global event.
Right, the cartoon villain theory.
Yeah, the reality is much more complex, much more structural, and honestly, a lot more interesting than a cartoonish secret society.
It really is. Now, before we really get into the weeds, I do want to frame our approach today. This source material analyzes politically charged concepts, and it looks at regimes across the entire global spectrum.
Right, from the US to China and everything in between.
Exactly. So we are not here to take sides. We are not endorsing any specific political system, nor are we validating any left-wing or right-wing ideology.
Absolutely not.
Our mission today is simply to act as your impartial guides. We just want to unpack the structural ideas and the analytical tools presented in this report.
Yeah, we are just looking under the hood to see how the engine operates, not arguing about where the car should be driving.
Perfect. Okay, let's unpack this. To understand how the world is actually run, the report argues we have to stop lumping all rich or famous people into one giant ambiguous bucket called the elite.
Right, that word gets thrown around way too much.
It does. We have to separate the concept of power into two distinct flavors, starting with the state ruling class.
And to be clear, this isn't like every government employee.
Right, not the DMV clerk.
Exactly. We aren't talking about the clerk at the DMV or the public school teacher. It is the command posts. We're talking the executive offices, military chiefs, the senior bureaucracy, the judiciary, and the intelligence agencies.
The heavy hitters.
Yeah, the heavy hitters. Because their distinctive resource, the thing that gives them their juice, is public authority.
Right.
They possess the legally recognized capacity to make binding decisions. They can levy taxes, deploy armed force, classify information, and, you know, legally deprive someone of their liberty.
Which is huge. So contrast that with the flip side, the social ruling class. And again, this isn't just a synonym for the rich.
No, definitely not.
It's the groups that gatekeep major resources outside of the formal legal state machinery. We're talking corporate executives, media proprietors, leaders of elite universities, and in many places, religious authorities.
Right, and their distinctive resources are ownership, market position, cultural authority, and network closure.
Network closure, meaning they control who gets into the club.
Exactly. They control the levers that shape life chances. Max Weber actually talked about this dynamic a century ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he pointed out that bureaucratic office, the Stasi, is its own autonomous source of power, completely separate from pure economic wealth.
So they don't even need to be billionaires to have power.
Not at all. A senior civil servant with institutional memory, Access to classified files and technical expertise holds immense sway over a country, even if their personal bank account is relatively modest compared to a CEO.
Okay, so is it kind of like playing a board game where the state ruling class writes the rule book and has the power to send you to jail, while the social ruling class owns all the properties on the board and controls the bank?
That is a great analogy. And the catch to that board game is that the banker can use their capital to quietly lobby the rule writers to change the game mid-turn.
Wow, yeah. So they're playing on the same board, but with totally different rules.
They are playing on the same board, but they have completely different tools at their disposal. The state operates through commands and laws, while the social dominators operate through investment, employment, and prestige.
But wait, I have a question here. If a massive pop star or an athlete has hundreds of millions of followers and huge cultural influence, are they in the social ruling class?
That's a really common question, actually.
Because they definitely have social power, and they definitely shape culture, you know?
Right. But the report offers a very strict boundary here to prevent that exact confusion. It all comes down to durable institutional control.
Okay. Durable institutional control.
Yeah. A celebrity might have massive income and high visibility, but if they don't have institutional control, if they aren't gatekeeping life chances, setting up agendas, or controlling major organizational resources, they are not in the ruling class.
So fame is not the same thing as structural domination.
Exactly. Fame gets you a good table at a restaurant and maybe a massive brand deal, but it doesn't give you the leverage to dictate national fiscal policy or rewrite trade laws.
Right, so you have to look for the people who control the institutions.
Yes. The individual actor might be highly visible, but the person who owns the studio where the actor works is the one exercising ruling class power.
That makes so much sense. But that raises a massive problem. If the politicians have the authority, but the CEOs have the money, they are on a collision course unless they have a way to trade.
Oh, they definitely have a way to trade.
Right. Because the state needs money, compliance, and economic growth,
right,
while the social elite desperately needs favorable laws, property protection, and sometimes bailouts. So how does economic power turn into political power and vice versa?
So the report calls these bidirectional conversion circuits.
Okay, that sounds intense.
It's just a fancy term for how they trade favors. Let's start with how social elites convert wealth into state influence. You see this heavily through campaign finance, lobbying, elite intermarriage, and using media ownership to set the public agenda.
Okay, and the other way around.
On the other side of the circuit, the state ruling class converts its public authority into economic privilege. They accomplish this through licensing, public procurement, deciding who gets the billion-dollar defense contract, privatization of state assets, and something called selective enforcement.
Wow, okay. Selective enforcement sounds like a polite way of saying they use tax audits or criminal law to help their friends and punish their rivals.
That's pretty much exactly what it is.
But when you talk about converting wealth into state influence on the other side, does this mean all lobbying is just legalized bribery? Because if you look at the sheer amount of money flowing into politics, it certainly feels that way.
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, the report pushes back on that cynicism by relying on the OECD's contemporary integrity framework. That framework explicitly rejects the idea that all influence is pure corruption. Governments actually require specialized information.
What do you mean?
Think about it. If a state is going to regulate artificial intelligence or agriculture or pharmaceuticals, they need technical input from the producers and scientists who build those things.
Because politicians aren't engineers or geneticists.
Exactly.
They need someone to explain the technology before they write a law banning it.
Right. The analytical problem isn't that lobbying exists or that information is shared. The problem is structural asymmetry.
Meaning one side has way more resources.
Yes. It's about who can afford continuous high-level representation in the Capitol year after year. It's about who can credibly threaten to pull their investments across international borders if they don't get a favorable tax rate.
Wow.
Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels actually touched on this when they argued the state essentially exists to stabilize the conditions for the wealthy class to reproduce itself.
Right.
Because the state needs a healthy economy to survive, which structurally forces it to listen to the people who own the economy.
That is wild. You know, the report also outlines these 10 essential differences between the state and social classes, and one that absolutely blew my mind was the difference in time horizons.
Oh, that's a crucial point.
Because if you're a politician in the state ruling class, your power is incredibly fragile. You could lose an election next year. But if you're in the social ruling class, your family wealth, your corporate endowments, your elite network that can persist across generations.
Which perfectly illustrates why these conversion mechanisms are vital for survival.
How so?
Well, a politician with a short time horizon desperately needs the funds and media support of the durable social class just to stay in office.
Right.
Meanwhile, the social class needs the politician to protect their long-term wealth from being taxed or regulated out of existence by a populist movement. It is a symbiotic, though often incredibly tense, relationship.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. Once you understand these mechanics, how authority trades with wealth, you can start mapping how different countries mix these two power structures.
And again, the report isn't creating a moral ranking of countries. It's mapping institutional configurations.
Right, which I instantly thought of like corporate structure.
Corporate structures.
How so? Well, the report outlines three ideal types. First, you have large coincidence, which sounds like a wholly owned subsidiary, right? One parent company running the entire show, politically and economically.
Okay, I see where you're going with this.
Second, partial overlap, which feels like a really messy joint venture where the two sides have different goals and are constantly negotiating across the boardroom table.
Right.
And third, separation or conflict, where it's almost like a hostile takeover. The state actively expropriates wealth, or business coalitions try to overthrow the rulers.
Let's actually map those corporate structures onto the real world to see the actual mechanisms at play.
Yeah, let's do it.
If we look at systems characterized by partial overlap, your messy joint ventures, the United States and the United Kingdom are prime examples, though they operate differently.
How does the U.S. do it?
The U.S. features highly fragmented state authority. Power is intentionally divided between the president, Congress, the courts, and 50 separate states. But simultaneously, it has incredibly concentrated social and economic wealth.
So because the state is so fractured, the social class has to rely heavily on lobbying, campaign finance, and a massive revolving door of personnel to maintain influence.
Exactly. Whereas the UK relies more on a continuous status network.
Status network? Like the old boys club?
Pretty much. The report cites 2025 data from the Sutton Trust showing that, despite modernizations, elite private education still disproportionately pipelines people into both the state and social ruling classes.
Oh.
Pierre Bourdieu's theories on social capital fit perfectly here. It's not just about trading money for favors. It's about converting the cultural prestige of going to Oxford or Cambridge into political and economic dominance. The network itself is the conversion circuit.
That's fascinating. And if we look at mainland Europe, the mechanisms change again, right?
Yeah. Take France. They feature a very strong centralized administrative state. They utilize a mechanism known as pantouflage, which translates to putting on your slippers.
Putting on your slippers. That's amazing.
It refers to the incredibly common practice of senior civil servants moving comfortably from public office into highly lucrative private sector positions.
But, I mean, how does putting on your slippers actually alter state policy? Mm-hmm. If a telecom regulator knows they're going to eventually become a telecom executive, they don't even need to be bribed.
Exactly.
The mere anticipation of that future private sector job softens how they regulate today. The mechanism is almost invisible.
And we see a similar dynamic in Japan with amakudari, which means descent from heaven, where retiring state officials parachute into executive roles in the private sectors they used to regulate.
Descent from heaven.
Yeah.
These terms are incredible.
It builds a system of bureaucratic business coordination. South Korea, however, shows us a partial overlap, but with recurring intense conflict.
Right, because they have the cable.
Exactly. You have the legacies of a highly active developmental state continuously clashing with the cable, those massive family-run business groups. And this happens all while dealing with highly mobilized democratic movements and a judiciary that actively prosecutes corruption.
So the joint venture there is highly volatile.
Very volatile. Which brings us to the large coincidence models, China and Russia.
Right, where the state is the parent company.
Yes. In China, the party state is supreme. The social elites, the tech billionaires, the corporate managers are hierarchically incorporated into the state's vision.
So they have immense economic power, but the mechanism is fundamentally different than in the West.
Completely different. Economic power in China does not grant you the right to form political opposition or rewrite the state's agenda.
And what about Russia?
Russia operates on a model of presidential security dominance. There is immense private wealth, but the report notes that this wealth is politically conditional.
Conditional?
Yeah, it is entirely based on loyalty to the coercive security core of the state. Privatization created billionaires, but if an oligarch crosses the state apparatus, that wealth can be rapidly expropriated.
Wait, so if I'm a billionaire in Russia, I don't actually own my wealth in the way a U.S. or U.K. billionaire does.
Yeah.
I'm essentially just renting it from the security apparatus, and my lease can be canceled the moment I show political independence.
That is the defining feature of that specific structural model. The state ruling class maintains absolute veto power over the social ruling class.
Wow. You know, seeing these wildly different systems operate brings up a massive point of friction for me.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. When we talk about these rigid structures, the pipelines, the conditional wealth, the systemic lobbying, it creates a sense of futility. Like, if these structures are so deeply entrenched, does it even matter who we elect? Or are the politicians just cogs in a machine they can't control?
That is an excellent question. This raises an important point, and it's actually the center of a famous debate the report highlights between two political sociologists, Ralph Miliband and Nikos Poulantzas.
Okay, let's get into the theories a bit.
So Miliband argued that we should focus on the personal networks and elite backgrounds of state managers. He wanted to know if the Treasury Secretary went to the same boarding school as the banking CEO.
Basically, the personnel matter because they are actively colluding.
Right. But Poulantzas argued the exact opposite. He said the state has structural selectivities. He believed it doesn't matter who is in office because the structure of the capitalist state inherently forces whoever is sitting in the chair to reproduce capitalism.
Wait, so Poulantzas is saying that even if you elect an absolute radical to be the finance minister, the machine will force them to act like a traditional banker?
Pretty much. But the report treats this debate as complementary, not an either-or scenario.
Okay, so it's both.
Yes. Personnel absolutely matter, because institutions are operated by human beings with personal biases, friendships, and specific ideologies. Gramsci talked a lot about this with how consent is built through media and intellectuals.
Right.
But structure matters because those human beings are boxed in by reality.
So let's game that out.
Mm-hmm.
Say I am that radically reformist finance minister. I get elected, I take office, and I announce I am completely overhauling the tax system to dismantle the social ruling class.
Well, immediately you hit the structural boundaries. You are boxed in by your government's fiscal dependence on corporate tax revenues.
Okay, so I need their money.
Yes. And if you push too hard, capital flight occurs. International bond markets threaten to downgrade your currency, which causes inflation, which makes the voters angry at you.
Ah, I see.
And on top of that, you are bound by existing international legal commitments and trade treaties. The structure dictates the boundaries of what is possible, but the personnel you and your team decide exactly what happens within those very narrow boundaries.
Man, that is intense. So what does this all mean? The theories and the global blueprints are fascinating, but if you're listening to this and trying to figure out who actually holds the cards in your own city, your own industry, or your own country, what is the diagnostic tool?
It's a great practical question.
Because most of this feels like it happens behind closed doors, you know?
It does. But the report actually outlines an empirical research design based on four kinds of evidence that you can look for to map out these power structures yourself without jumping to assumptions.
Oh, nice. What are they?
First, positional evidence. Who formally holds the offices and the board seats.
Okay, that's straightforward.
Second, decision evidence. When a new policy is proposed, who actually has the power to veto, delay, or rewrite it behind the scenes?
The silent power.
Exactly. Third, network evidence. Who went to school together? Who belongs to the same exclusive social clubs? Who sits on the same charity boards?
The Oxford and Cambridge thing again?
Yep. And finally, outcome evidence. Look at the historical results. Regardless of what politicians promise, who systematically gets the tax exemptions, the zoning variances, and the bailouts?
Wow. So instead of just following a trail of breadcrumbs, it feels more like looking at the plumbing in a house.
Mm.
You're trying to trace the pipes behind the drywall to see where the water pressure actually originates rather than just staring at the shiny faucets.
That is exactly it, because the shiny faucet is just the visible actor on the stage. And more importantly, the report asks you to look for the counterweights.
Counterweights?
Yeah, you analyze power by looking at who can be audited, who can be forced to testify in open court, and who can actually be voted out of office.
Right.
The ultimate stress test, the report suggests, is tracking time and crises. When a pandemic hits or a massive financial crash happens, who suddenly gains emergency authority?
That is so true. Crises reveal everything.
They really do. Who receives the immediate rescue packages while everyone else is told to wait? And crucially, do those temporary emergency powers quietly become permanent once the crisis fades?
That is such a practical, mechanical way to look at the daily news. So, to wrap this all up, the core lesson here is that the state ruling class and the social ruling class are intersecting but non-identical structures of domination.
Right, they're distinct.
Power isn't just a list of the wealthiest billionaires. And it isn't just a list of cabinet ministers. It's about mapping the circuits of conversion between them.
And applying this framework to the articles you read tomorrow will instantly elevate your critical thinking.
It really changes how you see things.
Exactly. Instead of falling back on lazy collective nouns like the establishment or the elite, you'll start spotting the specific mechanisms of influence. You'll ask, is this an example of structural dependence? Is this agenda control? Is this an institutional overlap like pantouflage?
You stop looking at the actors and start seeing the theater's architecture.
Perfectly said.
Which brings me to a final, slightly mind-bending thought from the report's conclusion that I want to leave you with. We spent all this time looking at how elites cross the boundary between state and society. We scrutinize the lobbying, the revolving doors, the campaign finance.
We obsess over it.
But the ultimate realization of this entire deep dive is that the boundary itself is politically constructed.
Yes. It doesn't exist in nature. It is entirely man-made.
Right. The people who most frequently cross the boundary between public authority and private wealth are the exact same people who write the rules regulating the crossing.
It's an incredible paradox.
It really is. The next time you hear a politician promising to aggressively reform lobbying laws, I want you to mull over that paradox. Going back to our theater from the beginning, the actors putting on the play aren't just performing the script.
No, they definitely aren't.
They're the ones who wrote the rule book for who is allowed to enter the theater in the first place, and they hold the keys to the doors.
That will certainly change how you watch the next political debate.
For sure. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the script.